You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, candy one, candy one. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Jen Zaman, and I am in for Judy Ansel, who is on vacation. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulig, PA, and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 124. Blake and Ulig, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We have been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEWlocal124.org, then you are not getting the best value for your money. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we take another look at how the Labor Party is reshaping politics across the pond in the UK. What does the rise of Jeremy Corbyn mean for the trade union movement? Then we'll head down to Swamp East, Missouri, to the Boot Hill to find out more about Governor Eric Greitens' plans for one of the historically neglected regions of the state. In the news, Republican politicians are laying out their plans for tax breaks and hikes, and Kobach and the dastardly voter fraud plan he has, and the FLO, Farmers Labor Organization Committee, is debating a law that can affect their ability to function. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Ario. And now for the news.
In another glaring hypocrisy, the same elements of our society that likely supported the Bundy ranchers are now rooting to hand over your voter data to the federal government that they built bunkers to hide from. Missouri is one of three states that has been fully compliant with the Trump administration request for voter data. Meanwhile, Governor Greitens just lowered the minimum wage in St. Louis by almost 25%. Greitens, meanwhile, fervently protected the privacy of his wealthy donors and compared questions about dark money influencing his political positions to asking people who they voted for. It hasn't taken long for Greitens to become just another Jeff City Republican. So much for new and outside the box.
It's been a big week in Missouri politics as Republican politicians lay out their plans for tax breaks and tax hikes. According to Republican leadership in Jeff City, this tax plan will lead to fewer taxes for every Missourian. But whether that means everyone is paying their fair share is another story, as critics have pointed to several elements of the plan as not in the best interest of many people in our state. For instance, plans to increase the cost of food are seen as unfair. They're an unfair tax on lower-income Missourians because they pay too much, a larger share of their income on necessities than their better-off counterparts. Additionally, Republicans wish to lop off a tenth of a percent off the top-tier income tax, which translates to another fancy vacation for Missouri's richest and less money for important projects for the rest of us. Pretty hypocritical for a group of people that rage against soda taxes to increase taxes on food across the board. But that's more or less where we've come to expect these days from the majority in Jefferson City.
The Farmers Labor Organizing Committee, or FLOC, is attempting to convince North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper to veto a bill which included a last-minute amendment that affects the union's ability to function. The amendment prevents farms from settling lawsuits with improved union contracts and forbids agricultural producers from directly transferring funds to labor unions to pay workers' dues. Justin Flores, vice president of Flock, said they would have to travel to each of the 700 farms in order to collect dues should this bill become law. The inconvenience would detract them from their main purpose of ensuring fair wages and labor practices for the largely immigrant membership base. Co-sponsor of the Farm Act, Senator Brent Jackson, owns a farm in Autryville, North Carolina. Flock helped settle a wage dispute between Jackson and several of his workers in 2014. Seven union members were forced to bring another complaint against the senator in 2016 for unfair labor practices. The workers were blacklisted from his farm. Flores says it's definitely unethical for growers who don't want to see their workers to have union rights, making it illegal. These are people elected to represent the state, not their own business interests. Representatives Jimmy Dixon and Dave Lewis, proponents of the bill, are also North Carolina farmers. They view the amendment as a right-to-work provision, a type of law which guarantees that employees cannot be required to join a union. Mr. Lewis nor Mr. Jackson were available for comment. The North Carolina chapter of the AFL-CIO has publicly denounced this bill. The farm bill was ratified on June 29th. Governor Cooper has 30 days in which to sign or veto. The measures in this bill will not affect current agreements with the union and its membership. Only agreements after the signing of the bill will be affected. The news tonight was read by Molly Madden, Keith Washburn, and Joyce McCauley.
Good evening, and welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jacob White. We're going to spend most of tonight discussing the Ameren deal, the Narenda steel mill in the Boot Hill, which was passed after a special session by Governor Greitens in Jefferson City. He signed the bill into law. And we're going to be talking with Professor Brett Gustafson from the Washington University in St. Louis. We're also then going to be having, joining us in studio, will be Judy Morgan, our local House representative, to give us some more specific insight into this specific case and what it means for Missourians, people in Kansas City, people all over the state. Before that, we want to talk a little bit about the elections that just happened in the UK, and we thought no better way to find out what's going on over there than to hear from the boy himself, Jeremy Corbyn. And so we are going to play a brief clip of a speech that he gave at the Glastonbury Music Festival. And after that, we're going to hear Casey Jones by the Grateful Dead. And we'll follow that up with a interview, some background about coal with Brett Gustafson and then Judy Morgan. So it's going to be a great show tonight. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. And without further ado.
If you can see that far, look on the wall right over there that surrounds this wonderful festival. And there's a message on that wall for President Donald Trump. And you know what it says? Build bridges, not walls. Do you know, politics is actually about everyday life. It's about all of us, what we dream, what we want, what we achieve, and what we want for everybody else. And what was fascinating about the last 7 weeks of election campaigning around Britain is, do you know what? The commentariat got it wrong. The elites got it wrong. The wonderful campaign that I was involved with, that I was so proud to lead, brought a lot of people back into politics because they believed there was something on offer for them. But what was even more inspiring was the number of young people who got involved for the very first time. Because they were fed up with being denigrated, fed up with being told they don't matter, fed up with being told they never participate, and utterly fed up with being told that their generation was going to pay more to get less in education, in health, in housing, in pensions, and everything else. that they should accept low wages, they should accept insecurity, and they should see it as just part of life. Well, it didn't quite work out like that, did it? And you know what? That politics that got out of the box is not going back in any box, because we're there demanding and achieving something very different in our society and in our lives. I think we should adopt a maxim in life that everyone we meet is unique. Everyone we meet knows something we don't know, is slightly different to us in some ways. Don't see them as a threat. Don't see them as an enemy. See them as a source of knowledge, a source of friendship, and a source of inspiration. And if I may, I'd like to quote one of my favourite poets, Percy Bysshe Shelley. The line I like the best is this one: "Rise like lions after slumber, in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew, which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few." I quote Shelley because he inspired like so many others do. I'm proud to be at Glastonbury because it inspires so many to music festivals all over the country. Let us be together and recognize another world is possible if we come together to understand that, understand the power we've got, and achieve that decent, better society where everyone matters. Thank you for inviting me here today. I'm proud to be here. Thank you very much. Best of all.
Hi, welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jacob White, and joining me today is Professor Brett Gustafson from St. Louis, from Washington University. Dr. Gustafson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jacob. Pleasure to be here. It's a great show.
Thanks. So today we're talking a lot about the special session that happened in May regarding the steel mill for the boot heel. And, you know, one of the big facts about it was that the mill to operate was going to take as much energy as the entire city of Springfield. So they had to make a special deal to try to get better energy prices. And you are kind of an expert in Missouri culture and as it relates to energy. So could you talk a little bit about how you got interested in that and maybe some broad observations about how big energy companies influence politics in Missouri?
Right. Two big questions there. Interested in it is basically being a citizen of the state and also a parent of children who are confronted with pretty bad air quality and, of course, confronted with the issue of climate change. So I came at it first as a concerned parent and then second as a scholar who's interested in politics. And here in St. Louis and at Washington University, we've seen firsthand how the coal industry and the utility, specifically Ameren, have a lot of power and influence over the city and even over the university. You know, we have students here who have been struggling for many years to reduce the influence of the coal industry at Washington University. And with some success, because it really distorts our ability to talk honestly about the climate and honestly about change. So I got into it for personal reasons and intellectual reasons. As far as the sort of the way I see the issue in Missouri, sort of skewed by the fact that I'm in an Ameren's region of operation. Certainly it's different in other parts of the state that may have a rural co-op or in Kansas City, which has to deal with KCP&L. But at any rate, it's pretty clear that Ameren exercises a distorted amount of political power in the state. Clearly it also exercises a distorted amount of economic power, because we're all dependent on Ameren for energy, and it uses that dependence, very similar to the coal companies like Peabody, it uses that dependence to basically tell us that there's no other alternative. And, of course, doesn't take much digging around. Ameren is the biggest lobbyist by far in Jefferson City. I think I just saw a figure, they had 49 lobbyists at work. Anheuser-Busch and Boeing have maybe 7 or 8, even giant Monsanto only has 3 or so. So the fact that it is using a lot of its resources to shape Missouri politics is not a secret, kind of an open secret. So we could talk some more about that, but that's basically the sort of overview I see. We need some radical change in our energy grid, and we're confronted with an opponent, which is Ameren, whose interests are in maintaining the status quo.
What are some of the arguments that they make in favor of the status quo? I think a lot of people are probably familiar with the criticisms. We could go into them more, but I think a lot of people understand that it's their political power that gets in the way. But what are, you know, when they're trying to make a reasonable case for the status quo, what do they rely on? What do they lean on?
Well, the message that they will tell us over and over and over again is that Missouri has cheap electricity. And that's a convincing message to a lot of people. It's not entirely true, but that's the message. Energy that Ameren, Missouri, on average, I think, is something about 10 cents per kilowatt hour. That's about 36th in the country. Meaning it's relatively cheaper. Ameren's residential rates in summer are about 12 cents. In winter, they go down a little bit. But that's what they tell us, that they're reliable and they're cheap. And that any sort of change in the grid or change in the energy generation mix could threaten that the reliability and could threaten the cost of energy. And as I say, that's a powerful message. They're very much manipulating people's economic insecurities. And over and over again, that's what we'll hear, that it's cheap and it's secure. I think that's about all they have. They also have a lot of other ways of suggesting that they are interested in cleaner energy. But if you sort of look at it critically, it's very superficial. I just looked at an Ameren video a minute ago. They're saying that they're going to have 30% of the energy mix is going to be cleaner. And you say, oh, well, that sounds good. Well, no, it's not. We need to be moving towards 100% renewables. And when they use the word cleaner, they're also talking about nuclear and landfill gas, which isn't clean. So they have other ways of sort of suggesting that they're interested in changing. But I think their big sort of club that they hit you over the head with is that any change is going to raise your rates. And for a lot of people, that's enough to keep them quiet.
And then they also impact the not just the ordinary people to think that they have the most stable and affordable cost for their energy supply, but they also do, like you said, put in a lot of effort lobbying in Jefferson City. And where does most of that lobbying, is it really just explicitly against renewable energy, or what are some of the other focal points that they're trying to influence in Jefferson City?
Right. Well, it's never really quite that explicit. Certainly their interest is in maintaining control over any changes that happen. And, for example, a few years ago, the citizens of Missouri voted to require Ameren to give rebates on solar and supply a certain amount of renewable energy in the mix. And Ameren fought to limit both of those. And many of Ameren's politicians in Jefferson City actually fought to overturn the renewable energy requirement. So that's one simple case. There are lists of legislation. The most recent one is the one that brings us to the show today, which is the steel smelter question down in the Boot Hill. The legislation that was passed was actually not so much tied to renewables, but was tied to, as you said, trying to give the steel smelter the right to a price of electricity which is below the cost it takes to produce it. So actually we're subsidizing a big private corporation with energy below the cost of production, so even cheaper than the cheap energy that they're always talking about. Now you might say, well, why does that help Ameren? Well, they're going to recoup the money they lose by passing on the costs lost to the more general ratepayer. So that was the big issue that many people brought up. But beyond that, what they had hoped to push through, and fortunately, even on the Republican side, there's some sensible legislators there who realized what was going on. They also tried to tack on an amendment that would weaken the capacity of the Public Service Commission to regulate rates. And so this is another example that is in their interest to increase their power to determine the energy path, whether it's towards renewables or whether it has to do with rates and so forth. I could go through a few more. They don't have that much hard work to do in Missouri because, unfortunately, Missouri is a very conservative state, and it doesn't take much to convince the legislature to push back against renewables. Another case you might look into is the Clean Line wind transmission system. The Public Service Commission denied its request for approval last year, I believe, or a year before. It's coming back up. It's not clear whether Ameren was lobbying against that, but it seems like they probably were. In the case of the steel smelter, the big sort of unknown is how much Ameren money has gone to Governor Greitens. Greitens went out of his way to call the special session. They bust in a number of people, many of them unemployed steel workers from New Madrid to Jefferson City. And that's dark money that may have come from Ameren, but because of the way the laws are set up, it's hard for us to tell. So, I could go on.
The opposition, the people who support, well, I guess they're not the opposition because they won, but people who support the rate cut and who support what's going on, a big argument that they've made is that this is going to be better for working people. There was a local Kansas City House representative, his name escapes me right now, but he said, you know, whenever he goes back to the Boot Hill, there's, you know, tons of poverty and stuff. So do you think that there's a way that the more environmentally oriented clean air side can also make a solid case for economic, you know, improvements using renewable energy and the turn to renewable energy? And do you think Ameren also fights against that?
Well, a big question there. Yeah. So one thing is certainly we're all concerned about poverty in Missouri. And I would be the first to argue that, you know, one thing that legislators should be thinking about is making regional economic plans that envision economic alternatives. Those may or may not be tied directly to renewables, but we can certainly be more creative than thinking, say, like Appalachian coal country, that, you know, coal's all we've ever done and coal's all we ever need to do, when in fact coal has impoverished the region. I don't know too much about the Boot Hill personally, but, you know, to argue that we should give Ameren more power just to bring back 200 steel jobs to the Boot Hill seems to reflect to me a lack of creative thinking.
All right, Professor, I'm really sorry, but I'm going to have to end it here. But thank you so much for joining us today. And is there a website or a Twitter that you would like people to visit?
I have one that mostly deals with energy questions. It's on Twitter at @energy_politics.
All right. Thank you so much. And we'll try to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Jacob.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Being a non-visual medium, radio has to take the extra step to paint a picture. Here are two such examples on the Thursday night special. First, at 7, it's the River and Prairie Story Weavers. Then at 7:30, Shots in the Night brings us their brand of sketch comedy radio.
Down the darlings or deer in drought. Close your eyes.
Good evening, this is Joyce McCauley, and we are broadcasting from KKFI for the Heartland Labor Forum. We're continuing to talk about the special session at the Missouri Legislature, and we're going to be focusing on the Noranda Aluminum Mill and the issues surrounding that. And I want to welcome Representative Judy Morgan to our discussion.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, I'm really happy you could come. I'd like to start out, I know you were one of the no votes, and I'd like to start out with just tell our listeners what your reasons were for
sure,
voting.
Sure, sure. Yeah, there were only 17 of us who voted no, and it was most definitely the hardest vote I think I took this entire session, because it was kind of a an issue of jobs versus electric ratepayers. So it was an issue where a company was going to be able to get a discounted electrical rates for their electricity, and it would have gone to the Noranda aluminum smelter, and it would have gone to a steel mill that would have located in the New Madrid County down in the Boot Hill. And it was just, it was a very tough issue because they were saying they were going to bring jobs into the area, which are very much needed. But the reason I ended up voting no was because they were going, the rates were going to be passed on to the customers in the Ameren area. And that's about a third of Missouri. So about a third of Missourians would have had higher electric rates. And most of them are kind of in the St. Louis area in return for these other two companies getting lower rates. And in some cases, I think that's fine. But in this case, the companies were making no guarantees on how many jobs they were going to offer. There was no guarantees built in. There was no guarantees on the wages, what the wages would be. There was no guarantee on what kind of capital improvements they would be putting into the two companies. And usually when the state gives some kind of incentive, there's strings attached. You know, it's like, We'll give you this incentive, but in return for the incentive, you've got to do this. You know, you've got to provide us with this many jobs, and these jobs have to pay this much. And there was none of that was done. You know, so that was one issue. And then another issue was that, again, the electric ratepayers would have ended up paying more for these two companies to get this discounted rate. And then the other thing that was very perplexing was that one of the companies, we knew who the company was that had bought out Noranda. It was a Swiss company called, I think it's like Magnum 7, something like that.
Yeah, that sounds right.
But when the House of Representatives actually voted on the proposal, we did not know who the steel mill was. We did not know the name of it, which meant we could not look at any of its financials to see what kind of if it was really a legitimate company, and so it was just a mystery company. And we were being asked to vote to give this mystery company this discounted rate, and we didn't even know the name of the company. Well, a day or two after we voted, I believe it was Tony Messenger from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Uh-huh. He actually found out the name of the company, and it was Sumangala Steel, and it was based in India. And so, but we didn't know the name of that company, and that was just really troubling to me that I was being asked to vote for something when I didn't even know the name of the company.
Yeah, I can understand that. One of the things as I was doing a little research on this, I did find the name of that company. And I was going to ask you, one of the questions I'd listed was, have you heard anything about whether they've even been down to the Boot Hill area? Do they have land they're going to use for this mill?
Well, the only thing, you know, we got reports from the person who was the sponsor of the bill, and this was what was difficult about it, because I think the sponsor was very much legitimate. He was trying to do something for his constituents. He was trying to bring jobs to his area. So it wasn't like somebody was being real evil in this, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, I think he had good intentions. And I think that he and maybe the governor had had some conversations with some of these folks, but nobody else had. But since I did check today to see what's the status of it now. I mean, we met in the end of May. The governor waited till the middle of June to sign the bill, which he brought us back into what's called an extraordinary session, which means it's something that you need to deal with immediately. And yet he waited till June the 14th to sign it. And since then, there's been nothing publicly disclosed about what's going on. So we don't know. We just don't know. We don't know if the Public Service Commission has started the process of looking at this to give them the discounted rate, because that's what it would have to come under. Ameren is one of the for-profit, investor-owned utility companies in our state. Uh-huh. Kansas City Power and Light's another one. There's a couple of others. And so they're all regulated by the Public Service Commission. So if they get a rate increase, it has to go through that entity. So we don't know if the Public Service Commission has even started considering it yet. Now, because of the legislation that we passed, they will be able to fast-forward it. It's usually a very long process to get a rate increase, but because of the legislation we passed, it's given the authority to the Public Service Commission to go ahead and do it without going through all the stuff they normally go through. But we just don't know.
That was the other thing I was wondering, is was this extraordinary special session really necessary? Because it seems like the utility companies do have a process.
Yes, and they do. And that's what I know at least one legislator got up on the floor, and she was one of the people who voted no. And she said, you know, there's already a process in place for them to do this, to go through this process to get a discounted rate on their electricity. And I guess something like an aluminum smelter, which is what Naranda was, uses just an enormous amount of electricity. And it's my understanding that the plant has to be on 24 hours a day. And so they can't ever turn off their electricity. So they use large amounts. But Naranda actually got a rate decrease back in 2015. They went to the Public Service Commission and they said, you know, would you give us a rate decrease? Because if not, we're going to go bankrupt. So the Public Service Commission gave them a rate decrease. The citizens of the Ameren, you know, catchment area ended up paying about $5.45 more a month for their electricity. And Naranda still went belly up. They still went bankrupt. They'd been bought out by a private equity company, oh, maybe about 7 or 8 years ago, and that company gave millions of dollars in dividends. And so, you know, I think that's part of why the company got into trouble. But Naranda had been a really good company that offered good jobs in that area. At one point, they employed about 1,000 people in that area, and they were good-paying jobs, and they were union jobs. But kind of through this process of this private equity company buying them, I think it became more about the stockholders rather than the people who lived there.
That's when I was reading the history of it. That's what it looked like to
right.
me, too.
And like I say, Naranda had a decrease just a couple of years ago, and it still was not enough to keep them from going out of business. And then this other company came in and bought them, and actually right now Naranda is owned by Switzerland. It's a Swiss company that owns them, and like you found out, and mm-hmm. I found out after we voted, it's a company from India that actually owns this, that's bought the steel mill. And from what I've read, they only have about three other locations, but they're all in India. So I think this is their first venture into the United States.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
Yeah,
the loss of this mill is so, you know, it's such a huge impact on this community.
Yes.
The Dispatch, they were interviewing some of the people in the area, and one of the former electricians said that he always knew he would apply there. After he got out of the Navy, that's just what he was going to do. And mm-hmm. that everybody in that community, I think they said, you can't throw a stone without hitting someone who either works there or who is raised by checks that come from there. And so losing this is just such a,
It was. It really was. And one of the questions that another rep asked on the floor is, why didn't the state offer other economic incentives? You know, there are other things, you know, that can be offered other than passing the electric rates, you know, giving one company a discounted electric rate and passing it on to others. There could have been, there's different, you know, tax incentive, you know, not paying your state employment taxes, you know, some things like that, other things. And they didn't even think about, the sponsor said they didn't even think about doing those things. They just, you know, Naranda wants this cut rate on their electricity. The other thing that happened during the debate on the bill, there was an amendment added, and what that amendment did is it said that any company with a new or increased utilization of more than 50 megawatts of energy per month would be able to come under this same discounted rate, just like Naranda and the steel mill. So what that means is, and say in Kansas City, and this would be a big company because only it wouldn't be a small business that would use 50 megawatts. That's a lot of energy to use a month. But if some big company did come in, or something like maybe, say, the Ford Motor Company decides to open up a new line and they're going to use a lot more energy, then in any of those situations, they could have come to the Public Service Commission to try to do the same thing Naranda is doing. And then the Kansas City Power and Light people, customers, they would end up paying for that. So that's part of this bill. It's not just the Naranda and the steel mill and the Boot Hill. This could actually impact, you know, every place in the state that's under utility investment profit-making companies. Now, there are some places in the state that are under municipal utilities or the rural cooperatives, and they don't come under the Public Service Commission.
Okay. Do you think that was one of the reasons for the amendment? Do you think that some people thought that incentive would bring new business into Missouri, some new factory jobs and that kind of thing into Missouri?
And I'm not sure if that's what it was or if just it was a way to broaden it so that it wasn't just making it look like we were just doing it from one place.
Yeah, yeah. This story has so many pieces to it. It's
really a complicated issue, and I've never served on the Utilities Committee, and that's the committee that actually heard this bill before it came to the full floor of the House. But I did learn a lot just by, you know, having to research it myself and get ready to, you know, it wasn't something that I went in knowing how I was going to vote. It was something that I really had to research and study and listen to all the sides and then come up with, which was a pretty painful vote for me to take because it wasn't fun voting against the possibility of jobs coming to this area, but I just felt like it was really bad public policy to do something like this when there are absolutely no commitments that the company has to make to get this reduced electrical rate. And then not even knowing the name of that one company, I thought was ridiculous that you can't tell us who the company is that's vying for this. So those were some of the, and of course, some of the electric ratepayers in that Ameren area, they were not happy about it because they were going to have to foot the bill.
Well, and then some of the people in that area are the people that are unemployed. And then all of a sudden now their utility rates are going to increase.
Well, actually, the people in the New Madrid area, they're not under Ameren. I know it's really interesting. You would think they would be, but I don't think that the people that live in that area are actually under one of the, I'm not sure if it's a municipal utility or one of the rural cooperatives, but it's one of the other two. They're not under the Ameren, umbrella. Uh-huh. So they actually get their utilities. But I think the reason is because if it's the municipal utility or the rural cooperative, they don't have the capacity to provide as much energy as what Naranda needed, and that's why Ameren did it just for that company in that area, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
So the people who live there are not going to actually be paying the bill for those plants. Mm-hmm. It's people who live somewhere else that are going to be paying the bill for it.
Okay.
Which that is another kind of, and I do believe we should help other people, but again, I just thought it was such bad public policy to not have those companies make any commitments. And so now we don't know. I mean, they could, you know, the Public Service Commission could give them the reduced rates and they could provide really low-paying jobs and there'd be nothing we could do about it. They could provide no jobs. There's nothing we could do about it because there's no commitment tied there.
Or they could just open up a part of the mill instead of opening all of
it
up.
And I think Naranda had no intent. Whoever bought this Swiss company that bought Naranda, I don't believe has any intention of opening up all of it. They are only going to open up part of it.
There was an article in the Dispatch, and that's kind of what.
Yeah.
What?
So it's not going to be the whole company opened back up.
Uh huh.
And the governor, I thought, really was very opportunistic in all of this. Governor Greitens, you know, because he's the one that, you know, this whole bill was considered during the regular session. And it didn't pass during the regular session. Now it had another little wrinkle on it. The original bill had a provision that would have allowed the electric companies to charge higher rates to their customers for grid modernization. This has been something the utility companies have been trying to get for a long time. And some of the senators believe that the utility companies should be able to pay for that out of what they, you know, you know, if you're a profit making company, why can't you pay for your own capital improvements? But what the Ameren and some of the other, you know, companies want to do that are profit making ones, they want to charge the customers for the upgrades, even though these folks are already paying for the utility bills. So that was part of it, that the utility companies would have been able to charge extra to customers for the grid modernization. And some of the senators were opposed to that. That's why it didn't pass during the regular session. That part was taken out in this bill, so that is not in there. That's how it was able to get passed in the Senate. But the governor just basically, you know, he brought in 200 or 300 people, had a big rally, took them up to the senator's offices that of his own party, of his own Republican Party, and had the had put notes on the door, you know, telling them they should vote for this. And it was just, it was quite a spectacle. But that's kind of the way he does everything.
Well, he's new.
Yeah.
He's new to this process.
Mm-hmm. But I know, and then of course he called a second special session on abortion, which I know is not part of this particular program. But I've been in the General Assembly. This is my sixth year. I had only gone to one other special session, and that was when Governor Nixon called one, because there was it ended up not coming to fruition. But there was a chance that Boeing might have brought some jobs here.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you can remember.
I do remember that.
Yeah, uh-huh. And instead, they decided to stay in Seattle.
Yeah.
And so, and I always felt it was really a ploy on Boeing's part to, they were in negotiations with their workers, and they wanted the workers in Seattle to make some concessions. And so I think they were threatening to move the company. So, now I did vote for that one because in that Boeing deal, there was a commitment that they were going to provide, I believe it was around 2,000 jobs, but they had to commit to that to get the tax incentive. And if they didn't provide the jobs, they weren't going to get the tax incentive. So I voted yes on that one because there were strings attached. There were like, you have to do this to get something out of us. But then it turned out that I think really the workers did make some concessions, and then Boeing decided to stay in Seattle. That's the only other special session. And that came up in December. There was no knowledge of it during the regular session, you know, because we get out in May.
Uh-huh.
Came up in December. You had to get your whatever grant paperwork proposal. It had to be in by a certain date. It was only a couple of weeks away. So that made sense to be called into special session for that. But we've been called into two special sessions now in, you know, just a few months. And that's just never happened before. And it's not the practice of most governors. Most normal governors, if they don't get what they want during the regular session, then they will come back the next session again. But this governor is just trying to bully everybody into getting what he wants now rather than just waiting till the next session. And I think he's doing it just for political purposes. If there was a really good Kansas City Star article just over the weekend, I believe, that talked about Greitens is only out for one person, and it's himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I saw that piece. The other thing that's interesting to me is he aware of how much this cost?
The special sessions?
Yeah, they,
I don't know if he is or not, but certainly, because we're paid our per diem, we're paid mileage to go to and from, you know, Jeff City. So the first special session cost $66,000. The second special session, I'm not sure how much it's cost yet, but it's generally about $20,000 a day for every day everybody's down there. And about $20,000 for the House and about $5,000 for the Senate. So about $25,000 a day that both chambers are there. So, yeah, you know, it's costing taxpayer dollars to bring us down there. And, you know, we are a part-time, you know, citizen legislature.
Uh-huh.
We are not a full-time legislature. I mean, I'm lucky because I'm otherwise retired, but from being a teacher and union president, but a lot of these folks, they have regular jobs. I mean, you know, and so they've got jobs that I remember it's kind of sad. And they have families, and one, I read some article that one guy was actually watching he was down there in the halls of the Capitol watching his kid's soccer game Skype, you know, by Skype,
yeah.
You know, because he couldn't be there.
Oh, because he couldn't be there.
Yeah, because he was a special session. So, you know, it's like if we were a full-time legislature, I could say, yeah, this is fine, but we're not.
That, you know, this whole thing has been so interesting, and I kind of broke it down in my head to like three areas, you know, the person area, the people area of the people that are out of jobs and that really need work, and then we have this money area of how much money is being spent to get this done.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, we don't even know exactly what we're going to get back as taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other piece that's too complicated to go into is all the business dealings with these different companies, the buying and the selling.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, when they went public for a while and were paying out dividends.
Right, yeah. And I think, you know, that's obviously some of the problem is they were not managed well for a period of time. And it's really unfortunate because, like you said, a lot of those folks down there, have worked at Noranda, have family and friends mm-hmm. who have worked at Noranda. It was a good employer for many years. I think they'd been around, gosh, I don't know, since maybe the 60s or something.
It has,
like that.
Yeah, it said 1960.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, they've been around a long time, and it was a stable, you know, stable kind of employment.
Yeah. We only have 1 minute. Oh, okay. And the only other question I had was I wanted you to comment on what government could do, how they could get involved to build up industry in some of these areas, because Missouri's not unique. You know, we've got so many areas all over the country.
Right, right. Well, you know, I think that most employers want a well-educated workforce, so that's something we need to work on. They want good infrastructure, you know, for transporting mm-hmm. things, and so those are some of the things that we can do. I think you have to have good schools to train people. You have to have a good highway system, you know, to get things around. So those are the mm-hmm. kinds of things we should be working on in the legislature, and then that will help bring business to the state and to our cities.
Well, thank you so
much. You're welcome. I was glad to be here.
And you know, this is the Heartland Labor Forum at KKFI, and we're going to pass it on to Safety First.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, and I'm not here to say that.
Hello, this is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, victims of UPS deadly drive for profit, summarized from rankandfile.ca, posted on June 23rd by a UPS worker, phrasing not changed. On June 14th, a 38-year-old United Parcel Service driver, Jimmy Lamb, shot and killed 3 co-workers, wounded 2 others, and then killed himself at the UPS hub in San Francisco. The UPS worker notes that the mainstream media made an issue that Lamb had a grievance with the company, as if this is unusual. Lamb had filed a grievance, a procedure used to address a violation of the team UPS contract over excessive overtime. In fact, many grievances are filed by workers every day at UPS. The problem is that many are blocked by management and take months, if not years, to resolve, if they ever are. To counter bad publicity after the shooting, UPS has issued a press statement in the name of CEO and Chairman of the Board David Abney. In part, the UPS family is deeply saddened by the tragic shooting in San Francisco on Wednesday when 4 employees lost their lives. The UPS worker asks, what is this UPS family and does it really exist? Does it include the part-time workers making only $10 an hour working in warehouses and loading trailers where temperatures in the summer can reach 130 degrees? Management, on the other hand, gets air-conditioned offices. Does it include package car drivers like Jimmy Lamb who work 12-hour days or longer with more stops per mile added on to increase work efficiency? The result of management piling on work is that some members of the family have to work late into the night only to get up early the next morning and start the process all over again. Mandatory overtime has become the rule at UPS, and many workers are at the breaking point. There's more. You can read the full post at rankandfile.ca, June 23rd. Next, OSHA to roll back rules on toxic mineral at construction sites. From the June 23rd New York Times, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration proposed on June 23rd a rollback of some Obama-era rules to protect workers in the maritime and construction industries from beryllium, a potentially deadly mineral. Shortly after President Trump's inauguration, the agency said it might peel away some restrictions, and OSHA's proposed new rule follows a lobbying campaign by sellers of a waste product known as coal slag, an abrasive use for sandblasting in shipyards and at construction sites. OSHA's step is another twist in a 4-decades-long effort to lower worker exposure to beryllium, an industrial material linked to a debilitating lung ailment called chronic beryllium disease, which is estimated to kill 100 people annually. If this proposal to weaken the beryllium rule goes into effect, construction and shipyard workers will die and be permanently disabled, said Emily Gardner, an advocate for worker health and safety at Public Citizen. The OSHA proposal would require shipyards and construction companies that use coal slag to meet the same new maximum exposure limit as the other industries, but it also proposes to exempt the two sectors from several so-called ancillary requirements, like medical monitoring and other specific safety measures. The Abrasive Blasting Manufacturers Alliance, an industry group formed by companies that sell coal slag, including the Harsco Corporation, had argued there was no evidence linking its use to beryllium disease. Public records show the group has spent at least $60,000 to lobby OSHA since January. OSHA is requesting comments at www.osha.gov news release for June 23rd. Finally, OSHA throws the book at local contractor for trench death. Lame excuses for ignoring risk from scienceblogs.com/thepumphandle for June 30th. It's maddening to read yet another again about a worker being killed in a trench cave-in. These deaths are completely preventable by using some pretty cheap equipment. The death of Donald D.J. Meyer in December 2016, Belton, Missouri, is especially tragic. The 33-year-old is survived by his son, Ashton, age 8. The youngster's mother died unexpectedly 2 years ago. On June 19th, OSHA issued citations against Aero Plumbing of Blue Springs for 6 willful and 8 serious violations and proposed a $714,000 penalty. See OSHA news release for June 19th. Aero Plumbing was responsible for making certain its excavation projects were safe. For D.J. Meyer and his co-workers, they failed. Even worse, 4 weeks after Meyer's death, OSHA inspectors found employees at another Aero Plumbing job site working on an unprotected trench. You can rent a small trench box for about $100 a day or purchase one for about $5,000. Brian Drake in OSHA Kansas City Regional Office and his colleagues have heard a variety of excuses from employers about why they didn't use a trench box or shoring equipment. Some of the most common: we didn't think we'd need it, we didn't think we'd be going that deep, and we thought it was just a quick job. This is Mary Ariel for Safety First.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for July 6th, the 17th. The Coalition of Black Trade Unionists and A. Philip Randolph Institute Community Health and Awareness Fair, Saturday, July 15th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Labor's Union Hall, 7820 Prospect, KCMO. Walnut Grove Neighborhood Association is also co-sponsor. Midwest School for Women Workers, July 16th through Thursday, July 20th. Registration, that's over with. SEIU Healthcare Demonstration to Support Fair Contract, Thursday, July 20th, 2 to 4 p.m. Research Hospital. And you can check out the Heartland Labor Forum calendar at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show.
Thank you so much, Molly. Well, that is it for our program this evening. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, it will be a show hosted by Tino Scalisi, and it's going to be about the UMKC layoffs and how they have hit both the labor studies and theater programs. I have been Jen Zaman. I've been your host and engineer tonight.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.